right, welcome to Logic Gate, where we are discussing the Star Wars TV show Andor on Disney Plus. I'm your host, Scott. And as always, I'm joined by my two friends, Doug.
Ooh.
And Jason.
Indeed.
Today, we are discussing Andor Season 1, Episode 10, entitled One Way Out. The summary online of this episode was, a rare opportunity opens, and the time for Cassian and his fellow inmates to act is now. So I think it's pretty clear the last two episodes were building up to a prison break, and that is what this episode is about. So before we dive in, any errata we need to talk about from last time?
Just curious, Nuge, do you know if Dan and Becky appreciated the shout out?
Yeah, they're pretty stoked, especially Bailey. She loved hearing her name.
Excellent. Okay.
Well, Bailey likes it. Bailey, this shout out this week is for you.
This podcast is nothing if not fan service.
We love you, Bailey. We love our fans.
Even if they're your children. Especially if they're your children.
Right.
Mm-hmm. All right. So I did take note and actually listen to the intro music this week instead of just skipping through it. And I took note that the intro music was kind of upbeat. It was a little bit hopeful. And it actually kind of sounded to me like it had some New Hope vibes. What did you do? You have any insight on the intro music this week?
Yeah, it definitely had more of a sweeping, like, John Williams-esque vibe to it, for sure. It was, I think I read an interview somewhere that as the show moves forward, the soundtrack will become less, like, distorted, less, like, sparse, and more full as, like, the rebellion, to represent, like, the rebellion coming into, you know, full effect, I guess.
Oh, okay. So the episodes, I'm just going to dive right in. There's a lot to talk about in this episode.
Yeah, I don't have anything else, so yeah.
I will say I was pretty happy when I loaded this episode up and I saw that it had a runtime of 41 minutes because the last couple episodes have been long and there's a lot going on. I was like, oh, hey, maybe this won't be so bad. We can power through this episode. But oh my gosh, it is a really dense 41 minutes this week for sure.
Yeah, but the B plots are very minimal. It's mainly focused on one. It's a simple, fairly simple episode. Yeah.
So the episode opens at the prison and they are zipping up a body bag of Olaf, the old guy who died in the last episode. And they are carting his body out of the prison and all the prisoners are watching. So they're all aware that whatever floor two is aware that he is now dead. I did note that the, I guess, what's the word? What do they load a body into an ambulance on? What's that called? Anyway, whatever it is in the prison, it's a hoverboard. So Olaf's body is zipped on this bag and it's floating out essentially. So we have fancy anti-grav, boards for transporting, medical people.
Yet another parallel to the Amazon warehouse dystopia that is this prison.
You think Amazon wants to have like floating body bags?
Yeah, they have like the hover carts and stuff that carry all the packages and stuff.
Oh, okay, there you go. All right,
and they have drones, I think, carry out their dead employees. I'm pretty sure.
Right.
Yeah. That's very Terminator 2.
Cassian and Kino talk about going tomorrow, quote unquote, going tomorrow. They make mention that now that Olaf is dead, that the guards will be bringing in a new prisoner to replace him. And that's pretty much the only time they really see the guards. So they need to take advantage of the guards coming down to visit them. I think at one point Cassian mentions, you know, we may not get another opportunity like this for months. So it has to be tomorrow.
So I was actually just a small amount annoyed. I think it's understandable, but I was a little bit annoyed because the last episode ended with Kino just being like kind of fired up. Like there's only ever 12 of them at one time. And like, he's ready. He's all in now. And then this one starts with him being hesitant, you know, Cassian saying like, we got to go. And he's like, oh, whoa, hold on. Wait a second. And I get that. Like, they needed to dial it back so that they had somewhere to go with his emotional range this episode. But it was a little bit annoying for me.
I didn't really make a note that they, that one of Cassian's lines, because they're debating, you know, whether or not they should go or not. and they're debating whether or not the guards have power over them or not, you know, or whether or not they outnumber them. And Cassian's line is, they just killed 100 men to keep them quiet. What would you call that? I'd call that power. So, I mean, the guards basically, I mean, they've killed hundreds of people and they just are, you know, attempting to sweep it under the rug. So it's definitely fresh on the prisoners' minds.
Yeah, there's so many great quotes in this episode. Something Cassian says, he says, I'd rather die trying to take them down than die giving them what they want. And
that's a great line.
It's awesome. And Kino, yeah, he's definitely like very considered, considering what's happening here. He's doing a great job acting. Just so much going on in his face. It's like worried, intense, like considering things. I mean, yeah, I love this part.
So at this point, the rest of the floor does not know about the whatever it was, floor two or floor five or whatever, that they all got executed and shocked. So they being Cassian and Kino, have just heard this from the doctor. So as they come back, they're telling the rest of the floor about what happened there. And actually, at this point, Kino corroborates the rumors. So they're hearing it from both Cassian and Kino. Mm-hmm. And this, I think, solidifies it for the rest of the prisoners that, hey, this wasn't just a rumor. This wasn't something we got on sign language through the hallways. Like, okay, this is a real thing.
Yeah, I think more importantly, I want to point out, like, Cassian has been put in this position. I mean, this is kind of the whole point, I guess, of this whole sequence is to put Cassian in this position where he not only needs to fight for himself and fight against, you know, the powers that be, but he needs to start convincing other people to fight. And become a motivator and become more of a stalwart type figure rather than just a rogue, all in it for himself type person.
No, you're dead on with that. That's been a beautiful part of his character arc. You know, starting off in the first couple episodes, he was the loner. He did things by himself. You know, he didn't involve anybody more than he absolutely had to. He even kept information segregated between his different friends. And then he goes on to being part of a crew and having to learn to work with a team. And now here we're seeing more of the leadership, like he's having to organize and get people on board. It's been fun to watch the growth of his leadership skills.
Yeah. And it feels natural. Like he's just kind of reacting to what's going on. It doesn't feel like forced. It feels like beautifully set up, really. So, yeah.
Yeah, so that's probably one of the big changes here. In fact, right at this moment is probably about when Kino kind of gives an impassioned speech to the men on the floor. And, you know, he lets them know that they're going to rise up and they're going to attempt to break out because of all the shenanigans that have happened. And he says, let's make it look good. So they're going to put on a show for these guards. They're not just going to, you know, I don't know what the word is. They're going to have to convince the guards that things are normal until they decide to jump them. But yeah, this is the first time where Kino actually really kind of addresses the whole floor and says, I'm on board with this now. Here's what we're going to do.
Yeah, they're kind of arguing about like what happened, like about the two ships that got fried. And then Kino's kind of like building to a boil and he yells out like, no one is getting out. And that seems like a big moment for him.
I'll also just kind of throw out there, and I think we'll maybe mention this a couple more times throughout the episode, but Andy Serkis is just freaking amazing.
Yeah, I got a whole section on Andy Serkis. We can talk about his character arc in this is amazing. So we said it in the last episode. I think we're going to say it again in this, certainly when we get to a little bit farther in the episode. There are two super quick scenes I want to go over real quick. It cuts to Miro at the ISB and they are talking about the pilot's death from the last episode that they were going to use to lure out Krieger. They have done exactly that. They have killed this pilot, I assume, and they have put him in his body or in his ship and kind of left him drifting. And at one point, they even say, like, oh, let's go investigate the ship. We want to make it look as real as possible so that the Krieger doesn't think anything is up and we can lure him out from his hiding place and then, you know, jump him or whatever. And then there's another super quick scene on Ferex where I believe it's, was it Senta? I can't remember who it was talking to the doctor about how Marva isn't taking her pills because they affect her appetite. So Marva is not doing so well on Ferrix. The next scene of note is Tay Kolma, Mon Mothma, and Davos Skulden in Mon Mothma's apartment. I did make note that Davos Skulden is extremely well-dressed. I mean, Mon Mothma is always well-dressed, but I almost got the impression like that Davos Skulden was, I don't know, like dressed up beyond a little bit. Like he kind of has this fancy looking coat on. And anyway, I mean, he's clearly like a high muckety muck and he enjoys his position and his power. And they are basically discussing, you know, the banking deal that Davo is going to help them with to hide the money from the heist. Davo at one point asks Mon Mothma about her husband, you know, what's he do? Or I don't see him here. And Mon Mothma just kind of shoots him down. She was like, I do not want to talk about my husband. I don't want to involve him in any of this. Like, this is a business transaction only. I'm here because you can help me with this money and nothing else. I'm not going to rope my family into it. And Davo actually makes mention, because he was talking about Mon Mothma and Perrin's marriage, and his line was, many cultures don't fully appreciate the clarity of the Chandralon marriage. And the implication here is that Mon Mothma is Chandralon, whatever. That's a race I wasn't familiar with. And Davo is also Chandralon. That was the impression I got. Like, so he was sort of commiserating with their marriage and their relationship. Like, they have complicated relationships. And he sort of understood why she didn't want him to talk about her husband, which explain a little bit about why she got married at 15 and became a senator at 16. Did you have something else on that?
It's more specifically, he wants his son to meet her daughter. He's got a 14-year-old son, and the Chandralon culture seems to be that like they get married super young. Because remember, they talked about Mon and Perrin, her husband, got married like 15, I think. She was 15.
Right, and, like, yeah. So it's essentially arranged marriage in that culture, right?
Yeah, and so this was like this was the only thing, like, catch that Davo required. He didn't want like a fee. He didn't want her to pay him for this help, basically laundering money. He wanted to introduce his son to her daughter. And this, I guess, seems fair, but she really freaks out about it. She's like, absolutely not. And is kind of shut down about the whole idea.
Yeah, she's really kind of coy about the whole thing. He says, oh, you know, essentially, what am I doing here? What can I help you with? And Mon Mothma says, we're exploring alternative financing arrangements for our foundation. So he's talking about charity. You know, I'd love to help you with that kind of thing. And yeah, she brings up like, oh, well, I need to move, you know, this 400,000 credits. You know, what would your fee be? And he says, oh, well, I don't want a fee. There's no fee. I would do it for free. And Mon Mothma says, I want you to take a fee. I insist. I don't want to owe you a favor. And Davo's line is, a drop of discomfort may be the price of doing business. So like he realizes like he has her over the coals, like he can basically extract whatever he wants from her. And yeah, ultimately what he wants is an introduction between Davo's 14-year-old son and Mon Mothma's 13-year-old daughter. And Mon Mothma was not happy about that. She was super angry at the offer. And her, like, the camera kind of cuts and zooms in on her face a little bit, and you can just tell how angry and intense she is. And Davo, like, that he leaves after she says, you know, that's non-negotiable, I'm not going to do that. And it just cuts to her, and she's just, like, shallow breathing and, you know, grinding her teeth. It was a really intense scene. I thought the actress that played Mon Mothma did a really good job of being super angry.
So it's an impossible position, right?
You know, absolutely.
Does she sell out her daughter to advance her political ideals, or does she abandon her political ideals and put her family in criminal jeopardy yet protect her daughter? That's tough, isn't it?
Oh, that's horrible. I mean, right. I mean, that's what I've told my kids. Your number one job as a parent is to keep your kids safe, is to protect your kids from physical harm, from emotional, you know, whatever. It's that's in my mind, that's my job as a parent. And like, this is, yeah, this is just a worst case scenario for Mon Mothma. She's already said that Davo is a thug. She already said she doesn't want anything to do with him. Like, she clearly despised this guy before he even walked in. And now he's basically proposing marriage between their kids. Yeah, not good.
Yeah, I guess I'm not as sold on as you guys are on this kind of scene. They have referred to the whole culture of marrying young a bit, but I guess I wish I got more context around this idea that just meeting, you know, introducing the son is such a bad, like a horrific thing. It's not like he's really requiring them to actually get married. They just want to do an introduction, but maybe that implies a lot more than it would lead on. But then I guess I wish they would have been more clear about it. It feels a little bit too mysterious, this whole stuff. You know, like she's even like kind of not so pleased with her daughter, right? Like they've kind of led us to believe that their relationship is strained. And I guess I'm just not totally sold on this scene yet.
I think a lot of it's implied, because I think that's why they set up the alternate culture. You know, I think that's why he opens with the Shandralan relationship talk. I think what I took from it was that it's implied that in a society like theirs, that marriages are prearranged, and that if I'm going to introduce my kid to yours, then it's going to be implied that they are going to get married, especially if I'm going to help you cover up $400,000. So you're right. Absolutely. It's not explicitly said, but I think that was the, if you're reading between the lines, that was what you were supposed to take away from it.
I would also back that up with, you know, the whole preamble about how showing how he's wealthy. Yes, but he's not a part of the societal elite, so to speak. He's viewed as a thug, as a criminal, and he wants to be part of that elite. Like, he doesn't really desire more wealth. He wants, as he said, something like, I'd like to be able to come back here. You know, he wants to be part of that society, you know, upper echelon. Forced marriage between his daughter and the senator, or his son and the senator's daughter, would be his foot in the door, so to speak.
Interesting.
At least that's what I took.
Or at least the relationship, maybe, like, just developing. He's networking, basically. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure. All right. So the next scene, we cut back to the prison, and the tables are working, but they are all communicating while they're working. But they are preparing and getting weapons because they know that the new prisoner is going to come down and replace Olaf. And I did note that Kino puts on a good show. Like, he still barks at him. He's like, oh, you know, I'm down two units and this is unacceptable, you know. So they are, as far as the guards are concerned, it's still business as usual. And Kino is doing what he needs to keep things moving. We see Cassian go back to the wall that he had opened in the previous episode and where he was cutting that pipe. Ultimately, what he ends up doing is cutting open a water pipe and basically spraying water all over the floor. So right about then, as he breaks the pipe open, the guards come in and they bring down a new prisoner. And Cassian, like, comes out of the back room, like, and he's completely soaking wet. I'm kind of surprised no one noticed, like, him coming out of the back room and being soaking wet, but nobody did. So that was good. And there is, I did note that there is a ton of tension in this scene, because the guards come in and they kind of do like a slow look around of the room. And it really draws out the tension of the scene. It's not like they just come in and the guy goes immediately down the elevator and they jump him. Like, there's definitely some Hollywood magic here to elevate the tension of the scene. So a couple of the prisoners, they stage a fake fight and they start to punch each other. As the water starts streaming in from the back room, the guards bring down the new prisoner, and it's I think Cassian jams, you know, a metal bar or something into the wall, which stops the lift about halfway down so it can't go back up. And then you hear the guards realize that that something is going on because they've rigged the elevator. And you hear the guards yell, "Spark the floor." And I mean, that clearly means turn the electricity on and disable all the prisoners. Kino advises everyone to jump on top of the table so that the floor won't shock them. Most of them make it, but more than I was expecting actually were still on the floor when the electricity went off, because it seemed like that would have been something you were planning for. But anyway, because the floor is coated in water, the whole system shorts out, so they can't leave the floor electrified indefinitely, because now the water has caused short circuit and essentially the electricity is off, at least in this room. Cassian climbs the elevator and he shoots a couple guards. Did you guys get a feeling from this? I almost got like a little Han shoots first again, where Cassian just straight up executes these guards. I mean, clearly these guards had it coming, but there was no hesitation from Cassian.
No. I mean, he's trying to get them out of the picture as quickly as possible. It doesn't seem...
Well, at one point, like, he knocks that guard down and he picks up the gun and he shoots the other one. And like the one guard just lifts his head and he just like points point blank at his chest and just blows him away.
Yeah. I mean, you're getting an example of how adept he is at, like, yeah, just when he has the chance, when he has the resources. Yeah. He doesn't like waste a second. I did want to go back to like when the floor shorts out, there's a moment. Actually, Kino, I think, is left standing on the ground.
Yeah, he almost doesn't make it. Yeah.
Well, he would have died, I think, but the floor, like the room gets dark, and then it zooms in on his face, and that's the moment you realize, like, oh, it's go time, you know. So this is where things like, and then he says like charge. It's like Braveheart. It's awesome moment. Yeah.
I do also want to touch on, you mentioned it earlier, and it's a running theme basically throughout the rest of the episode, but the tension, it's real. Like, they do a great job of just keeping you edge of your seat tense until the very end. And I was thinking about that, like, how? Why? I know Cassian lives. I know he gets out of here. I know he goes on to do other things. But I don't know that about anybody else. All these other characters they've introduced us to for the last two episodes, like, you have no idea if they're going to make it through this or not. And I thought that was really well set up.
A whole scene. Like, I mean, I don't know how long this scene is, 5-6 minutes. Like, it was tense start to finish. Like, I was, with you, I was on the edge of my seat. Like, how is this going to end? And I think that's a testament to the storytelling, right? I mean, like you said, you know, Cassian survives. I mean, he goes on to star in Rogue One, right? But like, at no point, like, am I sitting there watching that going, okay, this is unbelievable. I know what's going to happen. Clearly they're going to succeed. Like, none of that went through my brain. Like, I was, the storytelling is so well done that it could have gone many different ways, and it worked out well.
Yeah, I'm gonna say more about this like in conclusion, but like this is giving me like faith in prequels. Like, this, I mean,
yeah,
in most stories, you have a main character, you know they're not gonna die anyways, so it just doesn't matter that it's a prequel. But this show really makes it not matter that it's a prequel. Like, they do, like you're saying, a really good job of building suspense, building dread, and then turning that on its head and giving you some hope. And yeah, it's just brilliant. Yeah, story writing. So,
You know, I guess that's a good point. I mean, you could watch the show and not know anything about Star Wars, not know anything about Rogue One, and still be totally invested in the story and the characters. Just, you don't have to know anything about the universe. Like, this is essentially, it's both a standalone Cassian story and also a story in the larger Star Wars universe. So I think you get a little bit more out of it if you understand the larger universe, because you understand, you know, what the Empire is doing and where they're leading, but by no means is it required.
Yeah, indeed.
The next thing you see is, I don't know, I assume it's level 4 or level 6, whatever, that there's a level beneath where this break is, where they're breaking out, and the water starts to drip down onto the tables of the other floors. And so you see some of these other prisoners kind of looking around going, why is there water leaking from the floor? That's weird. So the prisoners of level 5 have now made it up the elevator, and they've killed the guards, and they're proceeding to run up the stairs and attempt to exit the prison, and they start freeing other floors. And there's some really cool scenes of them opening the doors and overpowering the guards. The one thing that I noted is essentially the entrance to every floor, there is, you know, a section of boots that the guards wear to keep them safe from these electrified floors. And they had shut off the electrified floors on floor 5, but not on the other floors, at least not yet. And I thought it was kind of curious that none of these escaping prisoners would have stopped and, like, grabbed a pair of boots, like, just to be doubly safe. So I'm the only one that made that connection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that they kind of, they showed the boots on the walls, like, earlier, I think the first episode of the prison stuff, you know, and I thought that was going to be, like, a hint to, like, oh, this is, you know, Chekhov's gun or whatever, where you show it, you got to use it, basically.
Yeah.
But no, it's not the case. And interesting. Yeah.
Well, it sort of reminds me, they had that big gigantic wall of gloves back on Ferrix, and we kept saying, like, they made a lot of point of showing this wall of gloves a lot of times. I feel like they kind of did the same thing with the boots, and yeah, they did anything with it. It's just all a red herring. I mean, it's not.
There's no reason to show the boots on the wall. Yeah. I mean, there really isn't. Like, you know, so it's interesting. I'm not mad. I might be mad at another show where, like, oh, maybe we're missing some context or something. But no, I feel like satisfied with how things. You know,
they were in a hurry and they wanted to get out. And I totally, you know, understand Cassian and Kino just wanting to get out as quick as possible because they got to lead this thing. But I felt like maybe, you know. One of the other prisoners, one of the, you know, unnamed prisoners, a scene of him putting on boots would have made sense. I don't know. Not a big deal. I just thought it was an interesting point.
Yeah.
So right about here. So now we are in full on prison break mode. So not only is floor 5 out and attempting to escape, but they are opening the doors for the other floor. So pretty much everyone is escaping now. Kino and Cassian are the first to the top of the stairs, and they break into the main control room. And Cassian comes in and they point guns at the guards and he says, shut down the floors everywhere. So they want the entire place shut down so that the other floors are safe and they can't electrocute the other floors to stop the prisoners from escaping that weren't shorted out by the water. And the guard has a great line. He's like, it's all hydro. Once we turn it off, it takes months to get it back up and running again. And then they cut him off. Like, dude, you got a gun pointed at your head. I don't think we're really worried about how long it's going to take you to spin back up these hydro generators.
Yeah, that line seemed more aimed at the audience. Like, see, audience, once they turn it off, they can't just flip the switch and turn it right back on.
Yeah, that's a good point. I did like that Cassian shouts on program at the guards because that's what the guards yell at the prisoners all the time to get them to put their hands on their heads. So Cassian yells on program to get the guards to, you know,
respond. Let's not pass up Kino's Samuel L. Jackson moment where he's, you know, ordering the one guy who's like, shut it off. And then he's stumbling and stuff. And he just, without even turning his head, points the gun and shoots another guard.
Yeah, that was great.
That one leader guard, he tells him to turn it off, and then the announcer or the main leader dude, he says something like, oh, that could mean so many things, and then that's when he just shoots the other guard, like,
yeah,
you know what we're saying.
Yeah,
I'm sorry, did I break your concentration?
I did note, so they've had this booming voice throughout the prison that the guards use, and it's really kind of intimidating. It's clearly like a modulated voice, this deep booming voice that would tell the prisoners, you know, that to do whatever. And you see here in this office the microphone that they use to do that, and it's just three wimpy guards essentially in this control room, and it had very Wizard of Oz vibes to me. So you have these prisoners who are just terrified of this booming voice and these guards that are, you know, omnipotent essentially, and then they get into this room and it's just, you know, it's like, you know, a standard level 2 Empire guy who just talks into this microphone and sounds scary, but clearly it's just It's another guy.
Yeah, that's a great point. Wizard of Oz is a great comparison to what's happening. Even the voice modulation. Yeah.
So once they clear the guards away, they get Cassian encourages Kino to get on the microphone and give a speech to the rest of the prison that they are going to rise up. And so Kino kind of gives like a half-hearted speech, you know, his heart was not in it. And so he's telling the other floors what's going on, but like, it wasn't very convincing. But Cassian really kind of has to poke and prod him, you know, like, hey, you need to rise up and be the leader that we need you to be, because otherwise this prison break isn't going to work. And Kino does rise to the occasion, but it does take some encouragement from Kino or from Cassian. At one point, Kino does say that there are 5,000 of us, so there is an implication that there are 5,000 prisoners in this one prison. And I don't know if you remember at the beginning of the last episode when they're flying them in, there are, I don't even remember, multiple of these prisons out in the water. So if each prison holds 5,000 people, we're probably talking 50,000 prisoners, probably, just of what we've seen. So whatever is going on here, there are a lot of prisoners here. And it is worth noting that there's only a prison break on this one particular prison. So we don't know what happens on the others, but
yeah, I mean, this is my favorite moment of him on the microphone, the PA system, and just some of the lines like, you know, we will never have a better chance than this. I would rather die trying to take them down than giving them what they want. I mean, he starts getting really motivating, and he's just so much passion. You know, I was actually tearing up a little bit at this scene. This was great.
Yeah, for sure. Like, I'm not too much of a man to admit that I was definitely getting choked up. Like, this was a really badass scene, and it was really cool to see the characters.
And he starts counting,
rise like, to the occasion.
There is one way out. You know, that whole chant was awesome.
We know they fried 100 men on level 2. We know that they are making up our sentences as we go along. We know that no one outside here knows what's happening. And now we know that when they say we are being released, we are being transferred to some other prison to go and die. And that ends today. There is one way out.
Yeah,
I was about to run upstairs and start like throwing shoes and stuff at my kids. And like, one way out.
That's such, it was so haunting actually, because all the prisoners are yelling, they're all escaping and they're all yelling one way out because they're all, you know, underground essentially there. And so they're all running up the stairs and they're yelling one way out. There's a fantastic scene of a bunch of guards hiding behind a door. And you can see the prisoners running on the other side of the door and yelling. And I think at one point the guard just says, just stay low, you know, so that, you know, we don't want to. We're going to get crushed if we go out there because there's 8 of us and 5,000 of them. And all you hear is one way out as they run past the door. It was fantastic.
Just to reiterate that little point, though, it's interesting to me how they've shown us several different times throughout this that the Empire is, or at least in this prison, it's all about the projection of strength than any actual strength. Like when it comes down to actual conflict, we see the deep voice is just this weaselly guy with like the most punchable face ever. and we see the guards cowering behind the door. You know, they're not actually big and tough. They're scared and weak.
Their only real power was the fear of the floor, right? And once you take that away, they had nothing left. Because I think it's kind of implied that each floor had, I don't know, maybe 10, 15 guards, you know? And again, if there's 5,000 prisoners in there, like, I don't care how many guns and whatever you got, like, you're just going to get straight overrun by prisoners, just the sheer numbers, right?
Yeah, it's the hubris of, like, devoting so little resources to that many prisoners and just like you're saying the hubris of using the technology, because I guess it, you know, the technology had worked for a while, but once the prisoners were motivated enough, once they realized there was only one way out, there's no stopping them. So
Well, I guess that raises the point. So, you know, Prison Break aside, water, shorting the floor aside, like, you know, if they ever have to do maintenance on this floor or for any reason the floor stops working, like, they lose all of their leverage, right? I mean, because there's clearly not even enough guards per floor to keep the floor in check, so...
Now you're getting into like logical, like technical details and stuff. I mean, yeah, that's fair, you know, but
it's a valid point.
Yeah,
but it definitely goes back to the hubris, right? I mean, they're just resting on their laurels, like they're relying on their technology. I mean, ultimately, isn't that what happens in New Hope? I mean, you got this big gigantic Death Star, and they're like, well, we have this big weapon. Like, what do we have to worry about? You know, like, oh wait, it's got a flaw, right?
You mentioned maintenance. I'm just imagining like maybe another version is like there's a janitor with a mop and he comes through the floor and the prisoners slowly think like, wait a second, if he's got water in the mop, maybe the floors are not on. that's the other dumb way of getting a jump on it. Yeah, I don't know.
Well, ultimately the prison break succeeds and all the prisoners make it to the top of the prison and they basically start jumping off and into the water so they can swim to shore.
I have a question.
Yes.
Sorry, real quick, backing up just a half step. As they were leaving the central control room and, you know, making a run for it.
Oh, yes. I'd made a note on this, too. Go ahead.
Why did they leave the guards alive?
That is exactly what I said. That would have been a fantastic moment for Cassian to shoot first, you know, cold-blooded like he did in the past. There's no reason to leave those guards alive. They have nothing to lose by taking those guards out and everything to gain. I would have loved it if Cassian just turned around and just shot those guards point blank once they got what they wanted and then they left. I think that was a swing and a miss.
It would have been the strategic thing to do, right? Why leave an enemy... you know, at your back? Maybe there's weapon stashes that you don't know about. They're going to pick up a gun and start shooting you. I mean,
well, if nothing else, those guards can now identify Cassian as the one who essentially led the prison break, right?
Yeah, true.
So
yeah, I noticed that too. Yeah,
it definitely would have been true to Cassian's character to just execute them straight up. And I would have loved it. And it would have been totally fine with me. So as everyone starts jumping into the water, I mean, again, you've got essentially 5,000 prisoners streaming up and over this ledge, jumping into the water. You see Cassian look at Kino, who is really kind of terrified. And Kino says, what are you doing? We got to get going. And you just like, it's just a moment of heartbreak. You see Kino's heartbreak. And like, as the audience, I was just like, oh my gosh, he says he can't swim. Like, so he's got no choice. He's come all the way up to the top. They've succeeded in this one in a million prison break. Everybody else is getting out, but Kino can't swim, so he's forced to stay, We don't know.
Yeah. So, fourth wall break. The writers had a choice. They chose to do that.
Right.
To make it so that Kino couldn't swim. Why?
Well, I think that was just mean. I think, well, two things I thought was really interesting, because he says that to Cassian. He says, I can't swim. And Cassian doesn't even have a chance to say, oh, hang on, I'll help you. Or, you know, what can we do? Like, what happens is a prisoner knocks Cassian into the water. So Cassian doesn't even have a chance to respond, number one, which I thought was kind of cool just because it added tension to the scene. Like, there was no, oh, wait, Cassian's going to save him. It's okay. Like, the scene was over. And number two is I wonder if that doesn't explain some of Kino's hesitation about wanting to even attempt an escape, because he was very hesitant about wanting to escape at all. The implication before was that he only had, 249 days on his sentence. So he's like, I'm just going to ride it out and get out of prison. But I wonder if part of that hesitation also wasn't like, look, whatever you're planning, like, I can't swim anyway. So unless you got a boat or a helicopter up there, like, I'm dead.
Yeah, so that's like, exactly what I consider, like, I reconsidered his whole decision-making process through that whole scenario. Like, and he says multiple times, I guess, I consider myself already dead. Like, in his speeches and when he's talking to Cassian earlier, he says, like, yeah, I'm just going to play it like I'm dead and go from there. So, yeah, yeah. You're thinking back on the episode and re-evaluating like everything that he's doing and saying and stuff. Yeah. It's pretty crazy moment. It's also kind of like you know, this is the end of a 3-episode arc. He's a character that, you know, we're probably not going to see again, and it makes sense. This is a good way for him to exit. It's an interesting.
I mean, he has to go, doesn't he?
Right. Yeah, that's kind of the point. Yeah, I think
The way I see it, we talked about Cassian's, you know, leadership arc, and throughout this episode, like, Cassian's definitely the one organizing and motivating and pulling the strings, but he's using Kino as a figurehead to do it. You know, putting him on the mic, saying it has to be you. He's using his voice. He's telling him what to say, but the next evolution is Cassian has to do it on his own, you know, step up, be the leader all by himself. And I think that's what they're setting us up for. They're taking away that crutch.
Oh,
yeah. Well, I hadn't thought of it that way. That's a good point.
It is worth noting. We do not see Kino drown. We do not see anything other than he stays up on the ledge and does not jump in. I did read an article by the director of this episode, and he did confirm that Kino is not dead, and it is not out of the realm of possibility that he could come back in the future somehow.
Well, I read a similar quote from the director. He says that we don't see him die, and that now it's out of his hands, and it's up to Tony Gilroy, basically, at this point. So it's, yeah, you know,
he could be Gilroy, dead. Tony Gilroy, I know you're listening. Please bring Kino back. He was a standout character in this episode, in this series. So,
oh yeah, we know him. You know, Tony, you're listening, you're a big fan, along with Becky and Dan and
right
my daughter. You did the shout out, and Bailey.
Yeah, and Bailey.
Anything else we want to cover on the prison break / water jumping scene before I move on to the next scene?
Are we, like, once we get, like, maybe more fans, are we going to just, like, have to name them individually every time?
Sure. Yeah.
I would be down for that, because I don't know. Yeah.
I mean, right now we only have 3, so it's easy.
It's fine.
Yeah. The next thing we see is we see Luthen and Clea in their shop, and Clea mentions that she had went and checked something and the mark was gone. He wants a meeting, is what she says. So they have some sort of system where they monitor. I don't know. It's not clear what they monitor, but whatever. There was something there. I imagine it's sort of like Mulder in the X-Files, where he puts the X tape on his window to signify that he needs to talk to somebody.
Yeah, there's the markings when Clea was following Vel
in good point, correspondence.
So it's like, yeah, she says there was like one on the fountain, and they talk about, yeah, meeting this mysterious person. Yeah.
There's mention that it might be a trap, and they say it's been a year. I'm surprised he waited this long. So that they're communicating with someone, and it's been quite a while that they have talked to this person. So something is clearly up. So what we see is the redheaded gentleman from the ISB, one of the people that was helping out Mira with her investigation, and you see him walking through some underground tunnels. You see there's pipes on the walls. It's extremely dirty. So wherever he is in, you know, the sewers or the, you know, the underground, the infrastructure of Coruscant. And he gets into an elevator, and he takes the elevator down.
Want to note that he totally looks like a narc walking through this area. Just,
oh, you it's think so obvious. He stands out.
I don't know. I just want to note that he looks like an Empire narc for sure.
Yeah, for sure.
Are you just saying that because he's a ginger?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I thought this was kind of a cool piece of like spycraft. So he's on this elevator, you know, he takes the elevator down 30 floors or who knows, and he reaches up above the elevator, like on the ceiling, and there's essentially like a little Bluetooth headset up there, and he puts it in his ear. And you hear Luthen on the comm, and he says, if this is a trap, press the buttons for 215. So he's basically giving him an out, like, hey, if you've been followed or whatever, now is the time to bail out, and then I won't get killed, essentially. So it's Luthen and Lonnie have a discussion about his role, Lonnie's role with the rebellion. So it's now made clear that Lonnie is an inside man working for the rebellion inside of the ISB. So Luthen pulls like a master class in like intimidation. Like before, this is all over the comm, like before he's even met him, he's like, oh, hey, I hear you had a new daughter. You know, how's she doing? And so it's kind of clear that Luthen is essentially blackmailing this guy. Like, hey, we've got information on you. Like, you gotta toe the line and help me out, or, you know, it's going to be bad news for you.
Yeah, it's a very slight implication, and, you know, it would be a shame if something happened type of thing.
Right. Let's see. So Lonnie mentions that Miro is going crazy looking into Aldani and the stolen parts and looking for someone named the Axis that brings all this together. We, as the audience, know that Axis is Luthen. Lonnie does not know that, but he does know that Miro is looking for that person.
Yeah, he lies about connecting himself to Aldani. He says, you know, they asked me to help out and we declined. You know, their mission was too risky or something along those lines. Yeah.
Yeah. His line was, well, we were invited, but we declined. So I thought that was a really good, that Luthen is really good at his job. And it reminded me of that scene with Saw Gerrera where he kind of BS's with Saw, where he was like, oh, hey, you know, so that thing that went down on Aldani, that sure was crazy. Was that you? You know, so he's doing a good job of deflecting and not bringing attention to himself. At one point, Lonnie brings up some information on an attack on Spellhouse, where the Empire is aware that Krieger is going to be attacking this, it's not clear what it is, a base, let's say. And Lonnie says, yeah, you need to get information to Krieger that this is a trap, because if, you know, they go in there, then they're just going to get killed. And Luthen says, well, you know, there's no better way to let them know that there's a man on the inside than if I pull them back, then they'll know something's up. And Luthen says, well, it's only 50 men and you're worth more than that. So his relationship and keeping Lonnie as the inside man is he's willing to sacrifice 50 of Krieger's men and ultimately probably Krieger as well, just to keep the information flowing and to keep. And I think that, you know, it alludes to Luthen's character before, where Luthen is very willing for bloodshed, for, you know, furthering the desires of the rebellion. It, compared to, say, Mon Mothma, who was very unwilling to get her hands dirty. Like, Luthen has no problem with, you know, hey, it's only 50 guys. I mean, if 50 guys have to die, then that's what it takes to keep this machine rolling. Then that's what we're going to do.
Yeah, he's coming into view as like a very interesting Machiavellian type of character, but he's definitely shied away from credit. Like, he's not narcissistic, he's not crazed with, like, he's not power hungry. He seems like he has really good intentions, but, you know, he's willing to get very down and dirty and just about do anything to accomplish what he wants.
He's just
a really interesting kind of character. Yeah,
he's very okay just being a behind the scenes puppet master. Like you said, he does not want to be out in front, but he just wants to pull the strings.
I mean, he even seems to think that he's not going to see the fruits of his perception of his own like position or power or anything. He really is fighting. There's some great quote. He has a whole speech in this scene that is insane. You know,
you want to get to that real quick?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Cause that's what happens. Right. Right. So next what happens, so all of this conversation has been taking place over this, you know, essentially this Bluetooth headset. So they are not face to face. So what happens is the elevator gets to its destination and the elevator door opens and you see, you're not sure, but you see a man in a shadow with a cape. And the implication is that it's Luthen, but it's not entirely clear. And did you guys get like some serious Vader vibes from that first appearance when the door opens?
A little bit, but I have a point, but go ahead.
Well, so the point is that the door opens and you see like, it's this very like shadowed, room, and you see a person standing there. And you see kind of like a cape glowing in the background, and it's all in shadow, so it's all silhouettes, and it's kind of creepy as hell. So my first thought was like, that's not Vader, is it? That'd be really weird. But so then Lonnie and Luthen start talking, and it's clearly it's Luthen. Lonnie essentially mentions that he doesn't want to spy anymore because he has this daughter now, and he wants to be a father to this daughter. He doesn't want to get wrapped up in the rebellion. And at one point, you know, Lonnie's talking about all the things he's had to sacrifice to be a spy. And Lonnie asks, he says, and what do you sacrifice? And that's where Luthen has just this really cool, amazing speech. And I can't do it justice, but the one line of the speech that I noted was, I burn my life to make a sunrise that I know I'll never see.
Yeah, that's this cool thing. He goes on. Like, I share my dreams with ghosts. I wake up every day to an equation I wrote 15 years ago, from which there's only one conclusion. I'm damned for what I do. My anger, my ego, my unwillingness to yield, my eagerness to fight, they've set me on a path from which there is no escape. I yearn to be a savior against injustice without contemplating the cost, and by the time I look down, there was no longer any ground beneath my feet. I mean, yeah, and then he says that I burn my life to make a sunrise I know I'll never see.
Yeah, that's a great line. It's a fantastic line.
It is a great, yeah.
What is my sacrifice? I'm condemned to use the tools of my enemy to defeat them. I burn my decency for someone else's future. I burn my life to make a sunrise that I know I'll never see. Now, the ego that started this fight will never have a mirror or an audience or the light of gratitude. So what do I sacrifice? Everything!
I'm condemned to use the tools of my enemy to defeat them.
He
holds no... like illusion. He's not a good guy. And that was the beautiful thing with the framing him almost like Vader. Show him as a bad guy. Because he is. The things that he's doing are like just horrible. He's forcing this poor guy with a daughter like to be a spy for him. He's extorting him, blackmailing him into serving the cause of the rebellion. He strong-armed Vel when he forced her to take Cassian onto the crew. He's going to sacrifice Krieger and his men to, you know, keep hidden the secret. He's doing some terrible things.
Yeah, and now I'm no longer, like, questioning whether he wanted to, like, hit Cassian, you know, like, if it was Clay. No, I don't question that. He definitely wants to kill Cassian.
There was an interesting comparison on, I think it was on the Andor subreddit, and they were talking about Lord of the Rings. And one of the things that they said that to be a truly good character, to fully flesh out your backstory as a character, as a hero character, sometimes the best thing to do, or what you really have to do to understand what it means to be, you know, essentially a hero of the light, is you have to embrace your dark side to a point. And I think that's sort of what they're doing with Luthen, is like, yeah, he's breaking some eggs, but he wants to make an omelet. And if you're not willing to break those eggs, if you're not willing to sacrifice 50 of Krieger's men, or you're not willing to sacrifice, you know, Lonnie's kid having a dad, then you may not achieve the goals that you want. I mean, yeah, it sucks that you got to do terrible things and you got to make those hard decisions. But if you don't, then the long-term consequences are going to be way worse. Somebody has to make that call, and Luthen's doing it, right or wrong. So I guess what I'm saying is, we don't know exactly which way Luthen's character is going to go in the end. I mean, clearly, I hope he ends up being a good guy and him and Mon Mothma pull off a rebellion. But I think that's maybe part of what they're alluding to, is that you have to be willing to embrace the dark side to understand what it means to be part of the light mm-hmm. side.
Yeah, this show makes me more and more angry about The Last Jedi. Like, The Last Jedi tried to do that. It tried to be like, oh, you know,
yeah.
When they meet Benicio del Toro's character, and he's like, oh, I sell weapons to, oh, you know, the rebels, the resistance, you know, just like I do the Empire or the New Order or whatever. And it was like, oh, wow. So, but they didn't see any of that through. They didn't have any good examples. They didn't have any foundation for that. It was just exposition. Whereas this show really shows you the real gray area of good and evil. There's not, you know, there's not like good guys and bad guys necessarily. There are bad guys that do good on the good team and good guys that are helpless and do nothing on like that are on the bad team. They just get swept up into it. And this show does just a great example of showing all of that. And that this is part of the theme of the episode for me is Luthen. For me, it's more about him communicating the fact that he really feels like he's not going to live through this. He's fighting like he's already dead, similar to Kino's speech where he's fighting for something greater than himself. He knows with the thoughts of I'm not going to survive, but I'm fighting for a greater goal. And this is what Luthen is his whole speech is about for me. And this is my prediction for Luthen is he's going to die with no credit. He's going to die. He's going to be unrecognized. He's not going to be known for anything in the rebellion, but he'll be one of the most important figures that we see in the show that brought about the modern rebellion. This is my prediction. So.
I think that's a very solid prediction because remember that was also kind of a theme of Rogue One was you really got a close up look at these heroic rebellion fighters who got the plans to the Death Star and you never knew about them. Like the original trilogy, like you never hear about this group that stole the Death Star plans. Like it's just a throwaway line and that's it. So that's
was it a theme in the writing or was it just maybe something that happened in that movie and that didn't have any real story structure to it? Okay. Maybe.
Well, we're going to rewatch that movie. I think you definitely need to.
Oh, a fight is a broom. Sure.
I think one thing that this show does a really good job. So if you look at the original trilogy, like it was very black and white, right? Like Vader was clearly a bad guy. I mean, until the very, very end, like he was a horrible person. The Emperor was a terrible person. Like there was no middle ground there. And then you look at Luke and Leia, like the good guys were super clearly good and the bad guys were super clearly bad. So it was just a simple story about good versus evil. Then you have a show like this, where you flesh out like these characters like Luthen or like Cassian, who I mean, like Cassian is a good guy, but he's murdered people like in cold blood. And Luthen is willing to make these horrible sacrifices for the greater good. Like you see a lot more of that gray area. Like there is no truly, you know, a truly benevolent person or a truly evil person. There's a lot of gradation in between there. And this is doing a fantastic job of showing what a more realistic, you know, vision of the Empire and the rebellion that, you know, these people are flawed, right? I mean, if you look at the original trilogy, like Luke and Leia were flawless, virginal, perfect characters. Like they were largely, you know, I mean, there was no question that they were good. Like
a little incest never hurt anybody. But...
Well, I mean, other than kissing your sister, what are you going to do?
I mean, Han Solo was a bit of a scoundrel. But you're totally right. But in fairness, that was the story they were trying to tell. They weren't trying to tell this like deep, kind of dark, full of gray area heroes and anti-heroes. And it was absolutely just straight up good versus evil.
Well, it wasn't. I don't think it was. I think good versus evil was not really important to that story. It was just sort of a premise or, you know, a preconceived notion. It was more about the journey of specifically Luke. We could go into that for hours. I mean, we don't need to dig into that more, but yes, I agree, Doug. It was telling a different story. Yes.
Should we finish up
What I'm trying to point out here is that this is a very different type of storytelling from any of the movies, certainly from any of the cartoons, any of the other Star Wars stuff. Clone Wars is very clearly goods versus bad guys, right? All of the trilogy is essentially good guys versus bad guys. I mean, even to some extent, The Mandalorian is good guys versus bad guys, right? This, I think there's an argument to be made that there's, you know, that's not just good versus evil.
Yeah, this is.
So I think this is a standout in the universe as far as the storytelling goes.
This is Nolan's Batman versus Tim Burton's Batman as far as
No, that's a really good analogy.
Star Wars actually is to Andor, yeah.
Yeah.
It's very, yeah. I mean, whereas the original trilogy is very cut and dried and cookie cutter, this is a lot more of a gray area. Yeah. Let's wrap this up because there's a couple. So I have two notes on this last season, on this last or second to last scene. Number one, wherever they are underground, where Luthen is standing and giving this crazy soliloquy to Lonnie, there are no railings here. So this reminds me of the Death Star. I don't know what, clearly in the Star Wars universe, OSHA just does not exist because all of these places are just horrendously dangerous and all death traps. And number two, after the Luthen speech where it ends with, I burned my life to make a sunrise that I'll never see. I mean, so not only does Luthen give great speeches, because that speech, you made the hairs on the back of my neck stand up, but he is a fantastic character. And I don't know what's going to happen with his character, but I wrote, holy crap, is Luthen a great character? Give him a spinoff. I want to see the Luthen show. I want to see like the rise of Luthen, like what it takes for him to get where he is and to become ruthless and willing to make these sacrifices. So,
Batman Camp Nuge, though, I'm thinking he's going to die by the end of the series.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm thinking is going to happen. But if not, then I want to see what happens with him.
I'd watch a prequel to show a Luthen show and it shows like how he got to this point because he's definitely gotten to a very strange place.
So Rogue One was a spinoff essentially of Star Wars, and Andor is a spinoff of Rogue One. Has there been a spinoff of a spinoff of a spinoff, or would this be the first one? Tony Gilroy, make it happen. Luthen
yeah,
show.
Only if Tony Gilroy is in charge.
Right. It's not worth it if it's not Tony.
Mm-hmm.
The very, very, very last scene, you see Cassian and Melshi. So there are two prisoners. They have landed on the beach, and they are running barefoot in the sand to get away from the prison. It's now dark, so they must have been swimming for a while because it was light when they jumped in the water, but it was, you know, sort of dusk. But they do, so we do know Cassian survives and Melshi survives. So we do not see 5,000 prisoners hit the beach. We see two. I don't get the implication that most of the other prisoners died, but those are the only two that are shown. So it's worth noting that Cassian and Melshi do survive. We know that for sure. And Melshi, I did do a little bit of research. Melshi actually shows up in Rogue One too. I had to remember that. So I have a feeling that there may be a little bit more of a bromance brewing between Cassian and Melshi in perhaps in the next two episodes.
Yeah, I had to look it up too because I was convinced that Melshi was going to be important because there was like weird little scenes with Kino like talking to Melshi and stuff. I was like, what the heck is up with this character? Nothing happens in this episode, but yeah, apparently he is in Rogue One. So he follows with Cassian, you know, supposedly.
So that's the episode after we see the two of them running in the sand, the credits roll, and hurrah. So prison break successful. Good episode. Do you want to do, who wants to go first on ratings? I'll go first. All right, I'll make it easy on you. I love this episode, start to finish. It was a short-ish episode, one of the shorter ones of this season, but all of the story beats were fantastic. The B-plots were minimal, but they were all very relevant. Nothing in this episode felt like filler. It ended on a high note because the prison break succeeded. The story plot with Lonnie and Luthen was super cool. I loved this episode, start to finish, 10 out of 10.
Wow. Go for it, Doug.
I'm not sure I have much else to add to that. I agree. I loved the pacing of the episode. It was fun. It was exciting. It was all important. Like Baker said, there was no filler. Nothing really felt out of place or unnecessary. I'm not going to give it a 10 out of 10, but I'll probably give it a 9 out of 10.
Jason?
Sure. Yeah, 9 out of 10 is what I'm as well. I absolutely loved it. Like I said, it's like a great example of the gray area of good versus evil, like you were going into, specifically Luthen's character and just the dirty, chaotic mess that it is to like try to fight against an overly powerful fascist structure. It's so satisfying. It was such a satisfying payoff from you know the last two episodes. Specifically, I'm going to give the higher marks to that first prison episode for setting all of this up and to instilling that really heavy sense of dread and really heavy sense of we are screwed. Like that's the heavy lifting that had to been done to get to this point and to pay this off. And also, like I said, this is like really this show, I would say, single-handedly made me almost excited about the potential for prequels, like this and Better Call Saul. Like, you know, but the idea that I was so invested and so stressed and also so like happy about what was happening and the outcomes, despite it being just a prequel that we know, you know, we kind of supposedly know what's going to happen. But when you really think about it, like every show kind of has the expectation that the main character is going to live, you know, I mean, there are exceptions, but the idea of the prequel has become very sanitized for me with this show. And I've just become impressed. The other idea that I had about this episode is a little silly. But the fact that a major like structure, a major like social institution is being kind of like overrun, and we're seeing how fake and how paper tiger it is. Like, this is going to be weird, but I'm going to compare it to Twitter right now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. You know, we'll cut this part, but, the idea that there's like all these celebrities on Twitter, like kind of poking fun at the whole thing, the situation that's happening on that. It's like this giant dumpster fire of a site that used to be like really well respected. It was just such an institution of like media and journalism, has become just overrun with people just trying to take it down, essentially. And to me, it just felt so parallel, I guess, just because I'm going through it at the same time. So, yeah, there's that. So, yeah, 9 out of 10. Those are the points I wanted to bring up. Great episode. Absolutely awesome payoff for what was before it. I thought that some of the side plots were a little weak, like Mon Mothma. I was kind of getting, impatient with what was going on there. And there wasn't very much from Daedra, Amiro, and Karn. There was like nothing from Karn. So, a little awkward, but solid for sure.
We should add a tiny bit of context. If you're listening to this episode 5 years in the future and you're wondering what the hell Jason's talking about Twitter, literally 2 weeks ago, Elon Musk bought Twitter, and it's been kind of crazy since he got it taken over. So if you're listening 5 years in the future and you're like, oh, Twitter, I don't even remember. What was that? Because it doesn't exist anymore. Well, that might be why.
Yeah, so much for being evergreen. Yeah, but this is, I assume right. It's going to make the history books, you know. It's insane what's happening with that. Yeah.
All right. So we've all talked about our ratings. The one last question I had for you guys is, we are now on episode 10. There are two episodes left in this season. What the heck happened to the whole plot with Cassian's sister?
Right.
That's going to be how they wrap up the season. It's got to be.
Yeah, that would make sense. They gotta pay that off somehow. They've only got two episodes left. You know, it's interesting that it hasn't come up at all, except for just like one mention.
It was in the very first episode. Has there been any other mentions of him looking for his sister?
Well, just that one scene, I think it was episode 7, that like transition episode where Marva says, just stop looking for your sister. But that's it, you know? Yeah.
I mean, they opened the entire show with this guy is, you know, going to the ends of the earth looking for his sister and then nothing. So I don't know where it's going. So I guess we'll see.
To me, it feels like a motivating factor for Cassian that's in the back pocket, but he's getting thrown around from like all these different situations. He hasn't had a chance to do anything about it for, you know, a while. He's a little tied up. So
there's been more pressing matters for him to deal with.
So I'm not mad about it, but yeah, we'll see.
All right. We've been talking for an hour. I think that's enough. All right, Doug, sign us off.
Okay. Out. Was that good robot voice?
Put you on the spot there. Holy moly.
Yeah. No, not exactly.
I totally gave him the heads up. I was going to see if I could throw you off, Jason.
Oh, okay. I'm the patsy. Got it.
You've abandoned the robot voice, and I resent you for that.
I'll tell you what, I'll do the next one.
Okay.
We'll rotate. And then, you know what? We can have the fans write in on Twitter. We can have them write in and be like, okay, who does the best sign-off?
Hashtag Logic 8 sign-off, yeah.
Hashtag, right.